One of the primary issues that I'm hoping some of the testifiers will talk to is the issue regarding the interplay between the FDA regulations and members. I hope you'll consider thoughtfully what role, if any, there is for the state in this area as we move forward. So, with that, I know Don Gerhardt from Life Science Alley, I guess we're calling you now, is here, and he's gonna start us off. So, Mr. Gerhardt, welcome. Please identify yourself for the tape and run through your presentation. And members, I think we're going to be able to be done in an hour to an hour and a half at the most. We'll be done in an hour and a half at the most. So we're gonna wrap this up and encourage people to kind of move quickly. But we want an opportunity to be, as Chair David says, fully informed. Even though we're not going to be voting, we want to be fully informed. So thank you, Mr. Gerhardt.
Mr. Chair, I'm Don Gerhardt, CEO of Life Science Alley, formerly Medical Alley MinBio. We really want to thank you and the committee members for spending time with us today. It's extremely important that we establish this opportunity to dialogue with you, giving you information about this very vital industry to our state, and answer questions that you may have. We will have three additional people speaking after I do. I'm going to give you an overview very quickly. You have a packet in front of you. I'll go through that with you in just a bit. We've got four goals for giving you this information today. First, just general overall information about the life science and med tech industry. The industry's status here in Minnesota is the second point. The third goal or focus is the importance of small companies in this business. It is extremely important that we maintain the health of small companies, and we'll hear from a gentleman named Steve Anderson about that. Finally, the fourth point is the industry and regulatory focuses on the quality and patient safety, referring back to what the chairman identified on the front end. So to do this, I'm going to provide an industry overview in just a little bit. Then, following me, Steve Anderson, the Vice President for Corporate Assurance, Regulatory, Reimbursement, and Quality at Acorn Cardiovascular, an emerging company here in the Twin Cities area, will follow me. Then Susan Albert. Dr. Albert is a MD and, MD and PhD, and she's the Senior Vice President and Chief Quality and Regulatory Officer at Medtronic. Finally, Joe Price, a senior partner at Fagery & Benson, who specializes in medical device and drug products liability and mass torts. So that will give you a broad cross-section of information relating to this subject. So let's get to the packet that is in front of you. On the left hand are the overheads that you're going to see me present to you. Behind that, we'll pull that paper out and page out and talk about that in a little bit. That identifies small companies throughout the state. There's some other information on the right-hand side, but that's, again, information, most of it for later for you, and will hopefully cause questions or give you answers about issues in our wonderful and vibrant technology and industry. So let's go on Minnesota Life Sciences Alley. The Life Science Alley was, again, formerly called Medical Alley MinBio. So I'm going to give you a lot of information relatively quickly about this. Originally, it was a 350-mile corridor or mile stretch of geography between Rochester and the north central area of the state of Minnesota. You could now take that is still houses the majority of the industry, but it's expanding throughout the state and literally throughout the region. So this alley that we talk about is literally over into the Dakotas, into Wisconsin, Iowa, and up into the prairie provinces of Canada. With that geography, you'll be hearing a lot today about devices. Well, there's a whole number of things going on with that science right now, and there is a convergence with bioscience. So you'll hear people talk about life science, medical technology, and bioscience. That's all beginning to do some interesting merging together. So the takeaway on this slide for you is just go across the top, and you can see how important and broad this industry is to the economy of our state and our region. Organic and agricultural chemical kinds of things, drugs and pharmaceuticals. That is a very quickly growing business and industry in the state. Clearly the medical devices and instruments, but our hospitals and laboratories and research and testing, i.e. research and testing, University of Minnesota or Mayo Research, et cetera. All of it does tie together into what we're talking about. Member organizations. This is just to give you an idea inside the organization that I run, what kind of member organization that there are. But at the same time, the takeaway point for you is that this industry needs all different kinds of companies participating in it, and it needs all kinds of expertise to make it work. Therefore, our universities need to put out the right kind of people. We need to be able to hire the right kind of people, et cetera. We'll talk about that in a little bit. The organization, again, that I run, Life Science Alley, has about 500 member organizations that are members of our association, and we employ, our member companies employ about 250,000 Minnesotans, and that number continues to grow as we broaden throughout the state and throughout the region. So it comes down to three things, another takeaway for you. If we're going to keep the industry healthy and make it continue to grow and influence our state substantially, we need talent, technology, and capital. We need money to make things happen. You know that. You're in struggles about that right now. Technology. We need to have the right kind of research engines. We need to have a healthy university, a healthy Mayo, a healthy MinSCU, et cetera. And we need to have the right kind of talent, the right kind of people that have the education and experience to make this go, because it is a very, it is a highly technical, highly precise kind of system that feeds this industry. This is a slide of 2000, but this curve has not changed. This is, take this slide with just a small tongue in cheek, because it's true. This is what the global device market looked like as we talk about the devices themselves. It was $149 billion in 2002. It's about $175 billion now, but it's the same curve that you see. But look, the fourth one over from the bottom, if you'll look, we've got Minnesota plugged in there. Minnesota has about $18 billion of international sales each year on its medical device, from its medical device sector. Just see how that ranks in the size of what's going on. Those aren't the dollars that we consume, but those are the devices that we put out into that international market. So our 10 largest medical device manufacturers, now there are about 350 to 400 manufacturers in the state. Just the 10 largest produce $18 billion. Now don't forget then, the smaller companies, the ones of under 100, employ more than the big guys. So there's an implicit number of that's closer to maybe $30 to $40 billion of sales, but we can't claim that. We can't absolutely define it.
Can I interrupt for just a second?
Yes,
Mr. Hart. Those smaller companies are the smaller companies in general manufacturing end products, or are they manufacturing components for products that Medtronic or St. Jude or somebody
it's
else?
It's yes to all of the above. So, okay. An Acorn Cardiovascular is manufacturing an end product. There are literally hundreds of companies. For instance, an example would be an injection molder that is doing a single part for Medtronic or something. That would be an example of a company not doing end product.
Thank you. Representative Wofford.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And kind of to that same point, those, since you said the 300 to 400 small manufacturers actually have more employees than the 10 largest, even though they're the biggest, is that because the 10 largest are actually doing a lot of manufacturing in different parts of the world in order to facilitate their product being closer to market?
Some of it may be. There's no doubt that they do some manufacturing elsewhere. But, for instance, a lot of their component manufacturing is done inside in the States. Their really high-end component manufacturing is done. Some of it is here. So, for instance, Boston Scientific is doing a lot of their high-end manufacturing and assembly here in town, in Maple Grove. But they may be, somebody else may be doing a covering for a catheter elsewhere and then shipping it to town for the assembly. That's an example. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Minnesota's small employees, about 70% of the people employed in that medical device world are in companies of 100 and less. So the implication there, again, is we need to keep them healthy because, one, they do a lot of the development of new products that are either go to IPO or are purchased by the larger companies or continue to go on and on as a smaller company who really invigorate the economy. Small companies employ at least as many Minnesotans. It's actually more than the larger companies operating in the state. So nationally, how do we measure up? You've seen some of these numbers, but the numbers that I'm showing you are so important that we continue to maintain those positions nationally and internationally because it draws and keeps good people. That's the key to driving this industry. So, health of citizens, best state to live in, we can recruit good people here, K-12 education, etc. A hidden one, that software engineering, is incredibly important to the next stage. As I showed you, the converging of bioscience and medical technology, software engineering is vital to that, absolutely vital. And we're rated number three in med tech development and production. So you already know about the knowledge-based business source, but you don't know about we're in the top 10 in the world in business and med tech patents. So it's an incredibly vital source of patenting and legal assistance, so we need good lawyers. We need good Joe Prices around, for instance. That's extremely important to the organization. That's the last time I'll say that we need lawyers around.
I was going to say, Mr. Gerhardt, I think that's the first time in my 4 years in the legislature that I've heard anybody say that. And I started referring to myself as a recovering lawyer because I'm no longer practicing, but thank you. The lawyers around the table, I appreciate that.
That was not meant as an insult. It was meant as a compliment to Mr. Price. He is excellent. So, world-ranking industry, Minnesota is the third largest med tech cluster in the world. Third largest in the states, third largest in the world. We need to make sure we remember that. Over the last decade, the 90s, the med tech industry increased 56% in the state. Is a remarkable number for a small state like ours, 5 million people versus California's. I won't go into the venture funds too much, but just know that it is a rich knowledge base, and you saw the patent number. All of that ties together, and that's why we draw so much of the venture funding for early stage and new ideas as a component of what gets spent in the United States. At the same time, we're in real trouble here, because there's no early stage venture funding out there right now. Just there isn't much at all. So our patents, we talked about that. A number for you, 2,500 medical device patents in 4 years. That's incredible. Growth potential. Those top four manufacturers, remember I talked about the top four? Now that one of them became two. I mean, two of them became one with Boston Sci acquiring Guidant. But the potential for 8 to 12,000 new jobs in the next 5 to 7 years is real. It's going on right now. So there's approximately 520 FDA-registered medical establishments, and about 350 or to 400 of those are manufacturers. The reason that we can't identify them specifically, the NAICS codes and others confound the exact numbers. So that company that is producing one... It may have 10% of its business in med tech and the other 90% goes to Ford Motor Company. They wouldn't really qualify as NAICS counts it, but the FDA would count them as a producer for Medtronic, and they have to be watched over. But the important numbers, we employ about 30 to 35,000 people, and they average $60,000 per year in their pay. And each job, this is a relatively recent number, literally about 2 months old, each job spins out 5.7 additional jobs. Now, those aren't all waitress and waiter jobs, but some of them are, but they're lawyer jobs, they are school teacher jobs, they are pipe fitter jobs, etc. An incredibly enriching opportunity to grow and keep it healthy. Inside your packet, one last piece, and I'll get out of the way. There's just a one-pager in there about an example of life science business activity in outstate Minnesota. I won't go through it all, but these all are fast-growing, really important businesses in each one of their towns, and they all represent different portions of that life science industry that I showed you with that was kind of that bluffed up slide early on the different parts of this life science industry. That's all I have. If you have any questions for me, Mr. Chair?
I do have one additional question. I don't want to spend a lot of time on the venture capital issue, but you mentioned there's a lack of venture capital that exists. Is that a statement that's a national statement, or is that a Minnesota statement? Help me understand that a little bit.
It's a national statement. It may be a little more difficult in Minnesota because we had such an active angel and investment banking participation up until about 4 years ago. So it may be a little more difficult here for the early stage companies.
Any speculation as to the cause for that, or kind of what's behind the lack of it?
Two or three things. The first one would be successful venture funds, as they are successful, continue to assemble or accumulate $150 to $200 million to invest. At that level, they very definitely don't get into real early stage investment. They just can't. They're not agile enough, or they aren't built to do that. So that's the success has changed that. I think we're beginning to see some small changes, but it's important that this state does respond some way or the other.
Thank you, Mr. Gerhart. Any other questions for Mr. Gerhart? All right. Thank you very much. Steve Anderson.
I'll let Steve introduce himself. Steve Anderson is from Acorn Cardiovascular.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. As Don said, I'm Steve Anderson. I am the Vice President of Reg Reimbursement and Quality for Acorn Cardiovascular. I have worked in the device industry since 1982, so I've got 24 years of experience. 4 years at Medtronic, 10 years at St. Jude Medical, 3 years with a German notified body, which is the European equivalent of an FDA for assessing companies, and then 7 years in the entrepreneurial sector. I am originally an Iron Ranger from Hibbing, Minnesota, schooled at the University of Minnesota. I've got a BS and an MS in biomedical engineering, and I currently serve on 3 advisory boards in the entrepreneurial sector, and I'm on 1 public board of directors, all located in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And I guess for the sake of complete disclosure and because of the political atmosphere, I should also disclose that I am pro-stadium and for the House bill. So I'll get that out of the way. Acorn is a startup company located in St. Paul, incorporated in 1996. We are developing surgical therapies for the treatment of heart failure. Heart failure is the only cardiovascular disease in the United States that is increasing in both prevalence and incidence. The mortality rate for heart failure when diagnosed is approximately 60% within 5 years. So this is a very egregious disease. It is the number one cost for Medicare nationally is treatment of patients with heart failure. Heart failure patients who are worsening despite optimal drug therapy have very limited options. Medtronic and Guidance, some of our local companies, have developed a therapy called cardiac resynchronization therapy, which has been quite successful, but unfortunately less than 20% of the patients with heart failure meet the indications for that therapy. So the other options for these patients include ventricular assist devices and heart transplants, both of which are extremely expensive, and heart transplants themselves, transplant hearts, are extremely limited in supply. Acorn's first product is something called the CoreCap. This is a passive restraint device designed to be placed by sternotomy around the ventricles of the heart. And I do have some show and tell here that I can hand out. I'm going to give a normal-sized heart, and then I'm going to give a heart that's dilated from heart failure with our device placed around it, so you can take a look.
Mr. Chairman, these aren't from some of those retired lawyers you were talking about, are they?
Now, again, I won't get too technical with it, but the CoreCap is, in effect, a soft cast. It's designed to reduce wall stress on the heart, and that will change the diseased cardiac cells. It will positively impact neurohormonal activation measures, and it will ultimately reduce the size of the heart. And these changes in the heart failure sector are called reverse remodeling, with the initial remodeling being negative and deleterious. The clinical results from the CORCAP have demonstrated a large decrease in heart failure-related hospitalizations, a 50% decrease in the use of ventricular assist devices and transplant, and an improved quality of life for patients. All of these changes were statistically significant. After verifying the CORCAP design, ACORN conducted a human safety study in Germany in 1999. We started there because it was a little easier to get started than going through the FDA. This safety study showed that the CORCAP was safe and had evidence of efficacy, and as a result, we received CE marking through the European Union, which is their method of allowing open marketing throughout the whole EU, in September of 2000 based upon this safety study result. In the United States, ACORN has conducted a very large-scale 300-patient clinical trial. This was started in 2000. The enrollment was completed in 2003, so 3 years to enroll 300 patients. We had 1 year follow-up of the patients completed in 2004. We submitted a marketing application to the FDA called the PMA in 2004, and we are still in the process of working with the FDA to get approval. So here we are. We're out there a ways now, going on a year and a half.
Help me with that again. I'm a little slow. I'm a lawyer.
Okay.
And I used to get paid by the hour, so I'd sometimes intentionally be slow. It took you how long to obtain approval in the EU?
It took
from start to finish.
From start to finish in the EU, it took us about a year and a half.
And so far here, through the FDA process, which obviously as the state legislature, we have little influence, if any, over, but
correct.
I'm just curious how long the process is taking.
Well, we are out at 5 years and 4 months right now and still pending. We believe that we're going to have approval by the end of 2006, but this is a very long, slow process.
And are you currently marketing and selling this product in Europe?
We are.
Thank you.
So again, around 10 years,
Mr. Chairman,
as you can see,
I was just asking Mr. Chairman, how long before you were allowed, even in the experimentals?
Can you hold that thought and I'll get through that?
Certainly.
So again, 10 years from incorporation, we don't have a single product on the U.S. market. As you can see, the design is fairly simple. I mean, it's more complex than just a piece of cloth, but it is a very simple design. It may be an elegant design, but the key is the amount of regulatory hurdles that you have to go through. So, again, that's the process. It's the U.S. regulatory process, and it is not simple. It is arduous and painstaking to go through. So, again, the CORCAP is categorized by the FDA as a Class 3 device. This is the highest-risk device that's out there. Class 3 devices require approval of a PMA marketing approval before you can market in the United States. And let me give you just a few ideas of some of the things that we will go through from a regulatory standpoint. So again, we had 2 years of design testing, including multiple animal models in sheep and in dogs, and this was needed to form the basis for doing an investigational study in the United States called an IDE study, okay? We then spent 6 months negotiating to begin that study, and that study, when you start off with a feasibility study, and you expand that study if you show promising results. We spent another 18 months after we completed that feasibility study negotiating with the FDA incessantly on getting a larger trial, so expanding to what we call in our industry a pivotal phase trial. We have had contract negotiations and IRB approvals at each of the 30 hospitals that were involved in the study. This is an extremely complicated process. We have had literally dozens of submissions to the FDA in that time that would include applications for a small business exemption, for user fees, for expedited review because it's a device that could have great public need, ID annual reports, which is an update on our clinical reports, approval of our PMA strategy, and amendments for any type of tweaks to our design, our manufacturing, our suppliers, and our clinical study. Each of those requires a submission. We've got dozens of conference calls, handful of meetings to prepare for each of those submissions. The PMA application itself consisted of 5 modules. I won't bore you, but the clinical module, which is the last and probably the most important alone, had 1,100 pages of data. We had an extensive audit by the FDA for our quality system regulation, which is, you know, the methodology by which we manufacture the device. We have had 5 audits of our clinical study by FDA's clinical division to ensure that we're meeting applicable clinical trial regulation. We spent 1 year working with CMS to get a procedure code for our device so that it could start to be tracked accordingly in the Medicare system. We spent several futile months trying to get an appropriate payment for the device, something that's called a DRG at the federal level. And ultimately, instead of being paid like other sternotomy procedures, we had what happened to us, what typically happens, they lump you into the lowest group that they could find and make you work your way up. And in fact, even though we are having a sternotomy done, or people are having open heart surgery, we are lumped into a payment group with a simple replacement of a pacemaker or a lead. So that's kind of the difficulty you go through. Now, in the U.S., this clinical study cost us over $30 million, and the costs are still going on because we have to track these patients out to 5 years of follow-up. Once the PMA is approved, we're not done. We're going to have a lot of ongoing activities with the FDA and with private payers and with CMS. We'll have a 500-patient post-market study where those patients are followed for 5 years. We'll have continued audits. We'll have annual reports that are going to be submitted to the FDA for our PMA. We'll have the reporting of adverse events to the FDA. And we will have continued negotiation with CMS and private payers to get both coverage and adequate payment for this device as it is placed through sternotomy. We expect this process to literally take years and years to get through. So in order to accomplish the above, Acorns had to raise over $80 million from venture capital and strategic investors. And I can assure you that the cost to us as a company, and what I mean cost, is what we had to give up to get this money, and the process was extremely arduous. So for all the reasons above, it's nearly impossible for small companies to pursue PMA-type devices anymore. The risks that the therapy won't work after you go out 5 years, the cost and the time for a return on investment to your investors make this really a haven for the large companies. And unfortunately, I've only detailed what's happening in the U.S. Europe, Japan, Australia, Canada, all have their own regulatory and reimbursement systems you have to navigate as a small company. So what I've tried to do is give you a snapshot of the complexity of our company. Our company was spawned from ideas and personnel from Medtronic, and most of the people in our company are from Minnesota, have come through Minnesota educational systems. But we are fighting, we're going up against some very difficult times, and I would say, if I can have one takeaway, I truly feel that we are at the stage where one more straw could break the proverbial camel's back. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Yes, Representative Zellers.
Yeah, Mr. Anderson, and this may even be for Mr. Gerhardt as well. Has there been any discussion at the federal level when we were talking about the trials that you had to go through, I think you said with dogs and with cows or another group,
right?
You know, pig hearts are sometimes used. Is there any talk of using, not necessarily the trials, but some of the actual patient research and patient data that you're seeing from the European side? Because I would think that, you know, although some of our trial systems with animals are similar, we're talking about real-life humans in Europe who've had these in place now, in some cases, it sounds like, for up to 7 to 8 years. And do you see the downsides of, from a policy standpoint or maybe from an industry standpoint, of using some of the European data here in America where these are actual human being trials instead of, you know, dogs, cats, animals, whatever?
That's an excellent question. The FDA is legally obliged to use animal data and to accept European data as long as it meets their criteria for valid scientific evidence. In fact, recently in 1997, there was something called the Modernization Act, and there was something called least burdensome requirements that was meant to make it easier to use animal data, for example, as a basis for an approval. In practice, that hasn't worked. We did a guidance between the FDA and industry, and unfortunately, it hasn't actually benefited industry. FDA has said that whatever they propose meets the criteria least burdensome, because if you don't do that, they'll ask for more. And in terms of EU data, there have been a few isolated cases where EU data has been solely used to justify a PMA approval. But it is isolated, and it's very technology specific. For example, the way heart failure is treated in patients in Europe and in the United States is very, very different. We need to make sure that the patients that we're evaluating in a trial are on optimal drug management, and the definition of optimal management with beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, diuretics is very different in the United States than it is in Europe, making the pooling of that data very problematic.
Mr. Anderson, and I want you to feel free to defer to the next two individuals, but if you put a product like this, you implant a product like this, and something goes wrong, either with the product itself or there's an issue with the patient, I have to imagine, although I don't know, that it's not quite as easy as going in and you know, changing something in a car engine. I mean, we're talking about a surgical procedure. Can you talk about that at all? Do you want the next two to talk about it? But I mean, that's one of the issues that arose with the bill that was introduced earlier this year. Is kind of, you know, these are devices that are implanted into people and are going to require a surgical procedure to repair or remove or replace.
Correct.
Can you talk through that a little bit?
This device is not an example of something that would be under that jurisdiction. For example, this device would not be explantable. The reason being is once it's placed on the heart, literally within days, you start to get a fibrotic reaction where that device becomes encapsulated into the epicardium of the heart. And so you would not be able to go back and peel it off. It will become one with the heart, one solid piece. And so ultimately what happens is that this is not a Lazarus effect where a patient has a surgery and immediately steps up and walks. What happens is, you know, it took time for the heart to dilate, and it also takes time for the heart to undilate. You can't immediately just squeeze it back to where it was. And so it takes time, and the heart will change over time, and the size will be reduced to the point where the device, once you get out to 6 to 12 months, is no longer doing anything anymore. Its effect has been obtained, the heart is smaller, and the patients are doing better. So this is very different from pacers, from ICDs, even from heart valves and stents.
Mr. Anderson, how many employees does Acorn have here?
Acorn has 35 employees right now. We started small. We've been as high as 50, and we've had to cut back a little bit during this delay of our PMA.
And are all the employees here in Minnesota?
All the employees are in St. Paul, correct. Right. We do all of our manufacturing, design. Everything is done at our St. Paul site.
Any other questions for members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to know a little bit more about your company. I assume you make other products and give us an idea. I just want to get a better view of
what. Actually, we have other evolutions of this product is a better way. It's horizontal development as opposed to different products. For example, this device is placed right now by a sternotomy. One of the key things that we're working on, and we're getting ready to start trials on this, is placing it in a minimally invasive manner, where you go through the ribs and not have to crack the patient's chest. I hate that term, crack the chest, but do a sternotomy to place the device. And so that will make it much easier. A second thing that we're looking at is prophylactic use. For example, right now the device is meant to be therapeutic for treating dilation after it's occurred. We would like to go in, and a lot of cardiologists believe that the grand slam for this device is to place the device after a patient has had an infarct and they have certain risk factors, and depending on the size and location of the infarct, you could place a device and stop the dilation from ever occurring. So it's a prophylactic application. And then the third thing that we're looking at is impregnating the device, the Dacron, with drugs, with cell therapy, and with gene therapy, and allow this would be a more optimal environment in which to facilitate the interaction of those three components. So you'd have a device that's efficacious by itself, along with a drug cell or gene that is also going directly after a therapeutic benefit. So oftentimes, you know, what you see in these first generations is just getting, you know, it's there's a tendency to judge the first generation on its own merit. And while you need to do that, you need to remember that the first pacemakers were, you know, this big and this thick, and that was the first implantable ones. The first ones were rolled up, you know, into a hospital room. To get these therapies going, you need to allow that evolution to continue, and that's what we're looking at.
Any other questions? Mr. Anderson, thank you very much for coming down, and you made me a little nervous there at the end when you started talking about prophylactics and impregnating. That's a whole other discussion that I'm not sure this committee wants to have today, but thank you very much, and thanks for bringing the show and tell. We're sometimes simple people, and that works well with us. So
thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Dr. Alpert, welcome.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
My name is Susan Alpert. I'm a Senior Vice President, Chief Quality and Regulatory Officer at Medtronic. I'm a PhD microbiologist and a pediatric infectious disease specialist. After doing all of that training and spending a few years in healthcare, I spent 13 years at the Food and Drug Administration, 6 years on the regulation of pharmaceuticals, 6 years leading the pre-market review program for medical devices for the U.S., and a year in food safety. I moved to the medical device industry about 6 years ago and joined Medtronic 3 years ago here in, as you've heard, a hotspot for medical device development. I know all of you are familiar with Medtronic. We're 57 years old, formed right here in Minnesota. We now employ 32,000 people worldwide and sell our products in 120 countries. So we're one of those companies that Mr. Gerhardt talked about that has an international, that puts our products into the international environment and has a tremendous amount of impact on healthcare around the world. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm really pleased to be here with you today. And I want to spend the time that I have describing how the medical device area works in areas of product development, quality assurance, and in particular safety, basically describing what we do to prevent problems on the parts of patients and healthcare providers with our products. Because a lot of what we do and who we are is in fact focused on making sure that our products are in fact as safe as we can design them. As you've heard, this industry is one that's based in science and engineering. And unlike the pharmaceutical industry, devices are designed, not discovered. Products for development are identified by healthcare providers in the community, doctors, nurses, physical therapists, and laboratory professionals. These individuals identify what aspects of the diagnosis or treatment of their patients might benefit from a new medical technology, and then they turn to us. For example, when a patient undergoes coronary artery bypass or CABG surgery, the vein that's used to bypass the blockage in the heart has to be harvested from the leg or the arm of that patient. Vein harvesting has been a time-consuming part of the total procedure. So the surgeons turn to the medical device industry to develop tools to make the process easier and faster. The industry responded, and today there are a number of companies supplying what are called vein harvesting devices, which shorten the overall time of the CABG procedure to the great benefit of patients. Less time under anesthesia, faster recovery, and reduced complications. To get from the need for a product to the product itself takes a complex set of activities, and Steve Anderson talked about many of them. In the interest of our time today, I'm going to clearly simplify the process, but I wanted to touch on those aspects of what we do that speaks to the issues around reliability and safety in particular. First of all, design work is done by teams comprised of engineers, biologists, materials experts, and physicians. And there are lots of other professionals who work with them. They identify all of the characteristics that should be in a product, as well as those that shouldn't be in the product, in order to meet the needs of the healthcare provider, the person who's identified the need to us. They select the right design characteristics and materials to meet that individual's needs. We make prototype products that are tested so that we can refine the design and then finally select and set one for further testing. Once the initial design is frozen, product is manufactured for complete additional testing, which includes such aspects as how the device, the final product, will perform, the biocompatibility of the total materials in the device, how they'll interact with the body, how patients will respond to these foreign materials, the methods that we're going to use to manufacture the product, and the expectation for the duration of the longevity of the product are among the things that we look at. Testing and the challenges we pose on these prototypes are designed to be sure that we can identify all of the causes of potential failure that can be anticipated, and that those potential failure modes are evaluated, as well as any other problems that might be related to components of these very complicated and complex devices. And you've heard a bit about the fact that many of our devices have lots of component parts, many of which are manufactured here in Minnesota. Then steps are taken, are identified and taken to mitigate any of the identified potential failure modes. Once mitigation steps for design are taken, the revised product goes back through testing, and then we move on to laboratory testing. In many cases, we're lucky because we can model human disease and condition in the laboratory, so we can test our device performances at the bench. It's not always appropriate or possible, but where it is, that's what we do. When that's complete, the full device or component parts are tested. For example, drug-eluting coronary stents, which I'm sure you've heard about over the last few years. They've been in the news quite a bit, the issues between J&J and Boston Scientific and the competition in the field. Those kinds of devices are often tested in the laboratory so that we can determine if the drug component and the dosage is acceptable for toxicity to the cells like those that line the arteries where these drug-eluting stents are going to function. And a lot can be learned in that laboratory testing. In addition, as Mr. Anderson has already described, when technology is really new, like the ACORN device, and untested, or where we make significant changes to current high-risk devices, human clinical trials are also done before a new or modified product can enter the marketplace in the U.S. A statistically determined, limited number of patients are exposed to the test device. And the experiment is conducted with careful oversight so that detailed data can be gathered to measure benefit and risk to those patients. A clinical trial is a protocol-driven human experiment in real patients designed to demonstrate and measure how the device actually provides benefit to patients and to identify and, where possible, to quantify the device's risks. The data from the design work, the bench testing, laboratory work, human studies, and all of the rest are evaluated together to understand what the device will contribute to healthcare, as well as what the risks are for patients who will be on whom it will be used for diagnosis or treatment. So we gather information about reliability and expectations for all aspects of the device's function. All of this work is done under the control of a company's quality system. A quality system is a set of processes and procedures defined in advance and overarching for the company to assure that all aspects of the company's work on devices throughout the product's life cycle is complete, well documented, and overseen by responsible staff, properly trained and fully accountable. In addition, the company's quality systems must meet the requirements of the Food and Drug Administration's regulations in the area. These regulations define what should be in a qualified quality system, and the FDA assures they're implemented properly by evaluating the data that we submit in our applications for marketing approval, and as well by coming and actually auditing on-site, performing inspections on-site in our companies, both for the existence and the aspect and the development of our quality systems, as well as the specific products that we design and manufacture. And they also monitor how we deal with information we learn in the field. Once a product has been cleared or approved by the FDA for marketing, the work on quality and safety doesn't stop. All of you likely know that engineers can't stop tinkering with anything that they put their hands on. And that's not any different in our industry. So we freeze a design and we have to force them to freeze the design so we can test it and then get it into the market. While other parts of the company are doing that, our engineers are back there trying to improve it all the time, trying to change how we manufacture it, trying to add new bells and whistles and make it even better than before. The changes that they recommend to us, as well as changes and additions and new things that our customers want us to put into the products, have to go through that same development system that I just talked about, from design all the way through testing, in order for those changes to be put into our products. And some of them also require new clinical trials. All of the changes that are significant, whether engineering changes or new properties of our devices, have to be submitted to the FDA for many of our products before we can sell revised and improved product. Companies also continue to monitor the performance of our products in the field in several ways. We continue to conduct studies of the product in actual use, what are called post-market studies, and you'll hear more about that from FDA going forward. That's to learn how the device is actually used by the healthcare community. We work with healthcare providers. They help us design these products. We develop them for a specific use, and then we sell them. And the physicians, just like the engineers, take them and do other things with them. They use them to treat other kinds of patients, other kinds of disease, or use them in different ways than we may have designed them. So we have a lot to learn from the healthcare professionals and the real-world environment about our device's performance. And like drugs and like other products, we also, in the real world, have to assess the impact of the other things that are going on with patients. Many diseases are chronic, and the patient continues to have an evolution of their disease. Steve Anderson talked about worsening heart failure. You can have worsening diabetes. You can have worsening spine problems. So we have to look at our devices in a changing patient, and also in an environment where other products, whether they're drugs, biologicals, or medical devices from our company or others, are all used to take care of these same patients. So we continue to learn about the impact of all of these things together on patients by doing these post-market studies. We also collect data from our users on the problems they encounter with the product, as well as their ideas for improvements. In addition, we request that failed products are returned to us for forensic evaluation so that we can learn if the mechanisms of their failure are the ones we anticipated in our research work and addressed in our planning and testing, or if they're new failure modes that we couldn't anticipate until the products were actually out and being used in patients. Mitigation, by the way, doesn't always get to zero failures, particularly with very sophisticated technologies, but it should significantly reduce the potential occurrence of those events. In these areas, we continue to try to improve our products and decrease the likelihood of failure from any of those failure modes. We constantly, therefore, monitor both failure modes and the rates of failure for our marketed products. Although we would like them to be totally risk-free, the fact that they are man-made, manufactured, and operator-intensive and not highly mechanized procedures, and that they're comprised of many components, it's hard to achieve perfect products. And the process itself is not always perfect. Random failures of components and devices can and do happen. But we focus a lot more on the non-random failures, the ones that tell us that we may have a problem, unanticipated, in design or manufacturing or in the way our products are being used, and that we need to address those problems. We determine the root cause of those events and study the results of our experiments to identify the actions that we need to take to mitigate those failures and their potential risks on patients. Some of the mitigations will involve changing how we evaluate our manufactured products, or how we write our instructions for use, or how we tell physicians and other healthcare providers about those potential failures and how they can help avoid any problems for their patients from the products. And in some small number of cases, we do have to bring our products back for either rework or destruction. The good news here is that in most cases where that extreme is required, the number of products is generally small, again, because of the way we manufacture our products. When a product has come from manufacturing, it's generally limited to a small number of lots or products, and we can make the adjustments and move quickly to resolve any potential problems in the field for those customers and for their patients. Of concern to companies addressing safety and performance is the fact that many of our devices remain in use, or in the case of implanted devices, remain in patients for many years. Since it's not logical or practical to test devices over that period of time before placing them in the market, we use simulations and extrapolations from testing, as well as learning from similar products to address those issues. Although we can simulate some use at the bench, we also continue, as I mentioned, to monitor products in the real world of use. For example, at Medtronic, we conduct what are called chronic lead studies. Leads are the wires that connect pacemakers and implantable cardioverter defibrillators, easy to say, pacemakers and implanted cardioverter defibrillators to the heart. It's the wire connection that the electrical charge moves on. We do those chronic studies by enrolling certain medical facilities and have their patients sign up to be followed until those leads either fail or are removed because the patient no longer needs it. In that way, we can understand what happens to the product literally over the entire lifetime of the use of the product. And as we put new leads, new products into the field, we continue to enroll new patients so that we can do this on an ongoing basis for these types of products. The FDA also has authority to work in the post-market arena. They can require a company, as Mr. Anderson said, to do post-market studies or to take actions on marketed devices. So as manufacturers, we're accountable to the FDA oversight on design, manufacturing, performance, efficacy, safety, durability in the field, and how we handle the information that we learn from our products once they are in the field, and how we handle complaints and issues with our customers. All in all, medical devices are among the most highly regulated products in use in the United States. And these regulated aspects of our products are as important, and if not more so, to us as companies than they are to the government. FDA can and does come into our facilities, as I mentioned, to actually see what we do, to review the data upon which we base our decisions, and also how we control our processes and our communication with customers and patients. Between us, companies and the regulators, the FDA, all aspects of devices from idea to obsolescence are under evaluation in an ongoing manner. The medical device industry, in particular the manufacturers of implanted devices, have gotten a lot of attention lately. Industry, government, and the medical and patient communities are all responding to the issues that have been raised and evaluating how safety, or more to the point, communications and conversation around risk can be improved. But what we have to make sure we keep in mind is that medical device issues are always about benefit and risk. No man-made device can be totally free from malfunction. However, we also have to remember that, for example, the reliability of ICDs and pacemakers is better than 98% to 99% at 5 to 10 years. The small risks of malfunction, less than 1 to 2%, must always be weighed against the risks of death. For example, a person who experiences a sudden cardiac arrest has a 95% chance of dying without an implanted ICD. One with an implanted ICD has a better than 98% chance of survival. We can't lose sight of this perspective as we continue to seek to improve these and our other devices. Finally, these and all devices are designed and tested by companies and evaluated by the FDA to demonstrate that the benefits outweigh the risks and that all recognized risks are mitigated as appropriate. I hope I've been able to convey to you the approach that's taken by our industry to address the prevention of any problems that we can anticipate for our products with our patients and with our healthcare providers. And now I'd I'd like to answer any questions you have. And if there are any questions about the FDA process, as someone who was kind of responsible in that arena for a number of years, I can try to help you with those as well.
Thank you, Dr. Albert. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions. What's an ICD, first of all?
Implanted cardioverter defibrillator. We call them ICDs for short because it's too hard to say the
okay.
other.
You got one word right. You were off. But I wasn't any closer. The other question was, you said you use simulators because it takes so long to see. And so many issues now involve the interplay between the body's growth of tissue and the device or whatever you have there. And it varies even between different humans. How do you have a simulator that can figure out exactly how the different bodies are going to, the tissue is going to react and things like that?
Well, we do a number of things, actually. Some of our simulation is actually computer simulation based on knowledge. You know, we make sort of make an idealized patient and use a simulation in a computer modeling sense to test our products. The other things that we do are we actually take tissue samples, tissue, and grow it in the laboratory and look at cell interaction with devices, and you can do that quite a bit in, at the laboratory. And as you've already heard there, in some cases, animals are used for some testing. But that really tells you why the clinical trials, and Mr. Anderson spoke about the length of time it takes to do some of these clinical trials so that we have adequate data over sufficient time. It's to address just the issues you're talking about. How will the body react to an implanted device, and how does that change over time? Because that's not something that happens at the time of implant. It happens over time as the body reacts, which is why for many devices, for example, with our spinal devices that are used for fusing spines in patients who have deformities and fractures and cancers in the bones of the spine, those studies require 2 years of evaluation of every patient before we can even submit to the Food and Drug Administration for approval, because it takes human confirmation in human trials over long periods of time to really answer all the questions. But we do as much as we can in the laboratory, at the bench, and on the computer to model as much as we can and to test as much as we can before we expose the first people to the devices. And then we have to do human experimentation, these clinical trials, to really understand. And that's why, as I mentioned, clinical trials are we design them to expose only the number of people that we need to this unknown and untested technology to learn what we need to, so that we can then be assured that the device, when it's out in the general public for thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of people, that we've gotten it right.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you. That brought up a supplemental question to my mind. How do you avoid the... I know a number of people that had, for instance, the early stents, and they had maybe 80% blockage or whatever, or 70% blockage, and they put in the stent, and they ended up with total blockage, not too long, because what happened there? Why was there such a bad screw-up?
Well, it wasn't actually a bad screw-up. The percent of individuals who actually had acute reocclusion within the first 6 months after stenting was about 30%, but that was actually much better than for patients who had just had angioplasty, just balloon, for treating that same condition, the blocked arteries, occluded mostly or partially occluded arteries. So the stents were better, but they weren't perfect. And that's why we're now in the environment of what are called drug-eluting stents. There have been developments to use radiation with stents and now pharmaceuticals on stents to prevent that reclosure, to prevent cells from growing in and reclosing when stents are in place, because that's one of the issues you talked about. It's the interaction between the body and the implanted material. And so now with drug-eluting stents, the rates of closure in the short term, in that six-month time, is down to single digits. And that's the kind of improvement we see. So we went from balloon angioplasty with acute closure to less than that with stenting, which prop open the artery, but still had some issues, to now drug-eluting stents that work over a much longer period of time for a much higher percentage of patients. And that's kind of how we continue to learn. And remember that stenting is a non-invasive, it's not a surgical procedure, it's a transvascular, you know, go in through the veins procedure. And so patients are not under general anesthesia and have all of that, so they don't have to go for a coronary artery bypass. They have this procedure, and it can be done multiple times in the same patient as more and more of their cardiac vessels are become problematic. And it really is an advantage for being able to manage patients without significant surgical intervention. So we learn.
Representative Liebling, then Representative Zellers, then Representative Fritz, and I'd ask members to try to be as quick as possible so we can move on to Mr. Price. I'd like to try to be respectful of all members. So do you have a question as well, Representative Lothar? Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Albert, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Albert. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I wanted to, I guess, stick a little more closely to what I think we're doing here today in the committee, and I just wanted to ask you, most or all of what you're talking about is what the FDA is doing and the regulation there and how what the interplay is, and I just wanted to ask you, is it all under the purview of the FDA? In other words, is there any piece of this that Minnesota has control over or any other state has control over? Can you just make that really clear for us?
Yeah, no, this is the development and approval and the following oversight for medical technologies, pharmaceuticals, and biologics is at the federal level, and they preempt.
Representative Liebling and Dr. Alpert, the one piece that I think Mr. Price is going to talk about a little bit where there is either a potential for, I guess, state involvement is the tort system. But I think if I'm understanding what I've heard today, the regulatory process is preempted by the federal government.
It is indeed.
But there may be some tort issues. I think that's kind of what Representative Cornish's bill back earlier in the session was starting to at least try to get at. So did you have another follow-up, Representative Liebling?
That's it.
All right, Representative Zellers.
Yeah, thank you, and Dr. Albert. Maybe back to my question for Mr. Anderson about some of the European data and the actual, you know, the human beings who've had these in and have used these devices or procedures or whatever, and understanding his answer with some of the techniques and some of the meds that we have on board here that they may not. You know, what is there? Is there anything? And I compliment you on being brave enough to mention to this group that you work for the FDA, because in full disclosure, I might have just given my current job title and left your FDA experience at the door. But we do appreciate that honesty and candor, because I think it will actually help us see both sides of it.
Yeah, the regulations that the FDA has in place say that it's reasonable assurance of safety and effectiveness for devices for use in the United States as medicine is practiced here, essentially. So that the FDA will accept foreign data, and does, both in support of starting clinical trials here as well as for approvals, as long as the testing that's been done and the experience, particularly the clinical trials that are conducted outside of the United States, are actually conducted in the way the device will be used in the United States. And frequently there's a mismatch there, so that FDA can say, well, the device appears to have some, you know, a reasonable expectation of safety and some benefit, but exactly how that will work in the U.S. needs to be retested in the system in which it's going to be worked, in hospitals with the drugs that are approved here, because Europe has different drugs, mm-hmm. and so we need to redo. When there are really good studies that come out of Europe, then those studies frequently are supported by a single small trial in the U.S. to confirm that data.
Mm-hmm.
In other cases, Europe doesn't always require clinical trials for approval of the medical devices. Their threshold is safety and performance, not effectiveness. So you can prove performance in a lot of different ways. And so for many of the devices that require clinical trials in the U.S., there are no trials in Europe. There's some experience maybe in use, but not trial data that FDA can actually evaluate.
Just a follow-up to that, Dr. Alpert. So, and after listening to Mr. Anderson, I thought about the, you know, maybe the next step. What about asking some of our European, and now I'll ask you to put on your Medtronic hat, in those countries as a corporation, tailoring the work you're doing in those countries that would match up with, or is that so ungodly expensive that you're shaking yes and no? So I'll let you answer.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. That's what we try to do. When we do our studies, and we've been public about our drug-eluting stent studies, we've done them in Australia, New Zealand. We did a large study in Europe. And those studies, in fact, are designed to meet both the requirements of the European Union and the U.S., and if we can, Japan and China and everybody else, because we believe that we want to do the least amount of exposure to patients and the best data gathering, do it once, do it right, and use it globally. And there's a lot of work actually being done in two venues. One is called the Global Harmonization Task Force, which is regulators and companies from around the world trying to get to more consistency. And another environment in which we're working is something called, I have to remember the name, but it's there's a group at Duke University who is trying also to develop global clinical trials so that we don't have to do this repeat work. So there is work being done in that arena.
That's encouraging. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I bet those conventions are a load of fun, Representative Zellers. Representative Fritz.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Alpert, I've been in this 40 years and worked in the long-term care industry and have gathered the data for many years. And I just wanted to ask and also comment on the pacemaker. Mm-hmm. Now, I remember 40 years ago we didn't have that. And I wonder when did that begin? And I sort of remember patients coming in maybe 1 in 100 with their little kit for me to check their do the pacemaker check routinely. Now they come in by the dozens. And, of course, I will also comment that there aren't enough of us to do them. But where does that data go, and where is that stored, and for how long do we continue to do this?
Dr. Alpert.
Well, actually, pacemakers started, and the implanted ones, about 50 years ago, but they weren't very prevalent. They were quite large, and so not everybody was the right patient for them. And they had to be checked in more difficult ways. As you said, they came in with all their equipment. Pacemakers are now about the size of a silver dollar, and they're easily implanted just under the skin and in the muscle and the chest so that there's not a lot of trauma to the implant, and our population is changing, aging. We've identified many more populations who can benefit from pacemaking. In terms of checking, you raised very good questions, and one of the issues that we've been working on and many other companies is not having patients have to come in and be checked, but to do it on the telephone, to do it remotely, from their homes, from their beds, from whenever they're traveling. They take their little modem and plug it into the telephone and send their data. The data is evaluated by their physicians and kept in their records at their physician's site. We do see some of that data when we need to see that data. That data is collected over long term. Much of it is used to study and develop newer devices. But we're doing that kind of remote monitoring at the clinic level so that nurses and physicians don't spend their time just doing checks. They can do that at a separate time with data and contact patients as they need to see them. Saves patients a lot of time, travel, and money. Saves a lot of work time on the part of the clinics, and then sicker patients get to be evaluated more rapidly. You're welcome.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Alpert. My apologies, Mr. Chairman. You always bring us such fascinating presenters, and there's never enough time. But given your unique background, and both having been in the regulatory and in the, within the industry itself, I wonder if you'd have any advice on how do we create a culture that really is true to honest assessment and quality, because I'm sure the temptations are just so huge. I mean, even within academia, there have been recent reports out about how research
done in the medical area in academic settings where there isn't the quite as lucrative of financial risks and rewards has been tainted just because of pride or pressure to, you know, be successful in their career. And I can't imagine it's even greater when you have, you know, tens of millions of dollars potentially from angel investors who are anxious for you to get a product successfully to market, or internally where there's pressure to say, wait a minute, it's time for phase six of this device to hit the market. And how do we encourage, or how does, you know, the bioscience organization or others create a culture in which you're rewarded for highlighting problems so they can be addressed?
Actually, you pointed out why, for example, we're such a highly regulated industry. We have the FDA oversight because, unfortunately, in academia, there isn't that kind of oversight. I don't know whether you saw recently, an article was published in the newspaper over the weekend, I believe, that talked to the fact that a lot of publications, journals can't assure that what they publish is real because they don't go back and look, as FDA does, at us. Journals can't go into the academic institution and review all the data and review all the work to see that it actually had been done. But that's what happens with us. So in our industry, the environment is one where we make sure internally to have the processes and lots of layers of oversight to assure that we're doing all the work in our quality system with management responsibility. And actually, in the quality system, the CEO of the company is ultimately responsible. He's the guy that will go to jail if there's a problem, because they spelled it out in the law, that we have layers of oversight. First of all, we put our name on the product, and we don't want bad product out with our name on it. And second of all, that we have a layer of internal and external oversight to make sure that, that things in the medical arena are, in fact, on the up and up, and that the right work is being done. And it really is incumbent on us as companies and incumbent on the environment, the physicians with whom we work, the researchers who actually do the clinical trials, to do them completely and to be totally honest and transparent about what has gone on, because that's the best way to get better product and more effective product into the market. And I'm quite proud of our industry. I think we do a really, really good job. I think that predominantly, and I thought this when I worked at FDA, or would never have left there to come out into the industry, that this industry does a tremendously good job. I wouldn't ever say 100% of everybody in the industry is perfect, but I think that the vast majority of companies working in this arena work in just the ethic that you talked about, and that maintaining and being able to talk about that that's the approach that's taken, and being transparent about what we do, and having the conversations as are now taking place with the clinical community and patients and patient representatives and other groups about how this work gets done, what we know, and a better understanding of risk and benefit, and a much more public discussion about risk and benefit goes a long way to what you're talking to, and that is that this all has to be done in a highly ethical and very monitored environment to be done right.
Just a follow-up, one of the things that I think Medtronic does well is that they actually connect their workers to the patients. I mean, they bring back patients on a regular basis to interact with the workers, so there's a real sense of not only accomplishment in terms of people coming and saying, wow, I have my life and my energy back because of your device, but also then the worker feeling like the quality of their work is tied to whether or not that happy outcome occurs. And I'm hoping that the whole industry will start to evolve a little bit more that way, even in terms of its language. Not seeing the doctor or the hospital as the customer, but seeing the patient as the customer. And I think it's just, you know, it's a language thing, but I think it really does make a difference in terms of how people define and their work and its ultimate impact. And I think the focus on the patient more than just the wonderful dollars that can be available is a good place to keep grounded.
And I think you'll continue to see that evolving. You know, we have a lot of people in Medtronic who spend their time in operating rooms, in procedure rooms, and working face-to-face with patients because that's their job. Their job is to be out there with the technology and making sure that the technology is working properly and is helping the patients. And you're absolutely right. When you're on the front line like that and the patient is with you,
you're very sure that your products are working right, and you want to be absolutely sure that you can rely on the products. And that's a key point in our industry, and we're quite different from other industries because we are out there, and we see the patients face-to-face on a day-to-day basis in operating rooms and in doctor's offices around the world.
Dr. Albert, thank you very much for your time today. Mr. Price. Mr. Price, I'm going to ask you to try to be as brief as possible. I know there's a lot of issues and a lot of ground to cover. I do want to allow a little bit of opportunity for members to ask questions if they have them, and I'd like to try to give us all an opportunity to get out of here as quickly as possible. But with that, please introduce yourself. And
yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm Joe Price. I'm a clinic attorney from Fagerty and Benson. I've been doing this for the past almost 34 years. And over that time, I've represented almost exclusively pharmaceutical companies and medical device companies, many of them from Minnesota. I'm proud to say that I've had the opportunity at one time or another to represent 3M, Guidant, Medtronic, St. Jude, and others, primarily in the area of products liability and mass tort litigation. And the one thing I've learned, if anything, over the past 34 years is that these Minnesota medical companies, the Minnesota medical industry, are really concerned about the health and the safety of those people who get their products. No company likes to get up every morning and see its name on the front page of the New York Times or the St. Paul Pioneer Press or the Star and Tribune being castigated for product recalls or for product injury claims. And I know from experience that the companies that we're dealing with here in Minnesota are companies that are most concerned and most interested in seeing that people get safe products. It's not good business to not be concerned, and it's not good business to not put out first-rate products. And what we have to remember here, and this all came up sort of in the context of Representative Cornish's bill, was that what you're dealing with is a product that is implanted in the human body, and there is no product, and I cannot say this as eloquently as Dr. Alpert did, but there is no product that goes into the human body that does not have with it some risk. All of them have it inherent, is absolute, and the issue is how you minimize that risk to the benefit of the patient. Because both from a medical standpoint and from a legal standpoint, defect or a defective product is measured in terms of risk and benefit. If the benefits of a product exceed the risk, that product is deemed to be safe. And that's true whether you're dealing in the medical area or whether you're dealing in the legal area. And what it really comes down to is a conveyance to the patient, usually by the physician, almost exclusively by the physician, of what the risks and the benefits of the product are, and then a decision made jointly, which we refer to it in the law as an informed consent decision, as to whether that patient wants to undergo that risk to obtain that benefit. What we were faced with the bill proposed by Representative Cornish was, in essence, to take a product beyond this sort of risk-benefit analysis to what we would call a strict liability or an absolute liability. That is, the manufacturer would be liable for all of the costs and expenses involved with a product that was recalled, regardless of the issue of defect or risk. That's something that Minnesota law and conventional Minnesota products liability law has never done before. The law recognizes that these products do carry risk, that they do have benefit, and that a balancing must go into effect between them. And Representative Cornish's bill, unfortunately, I think was worded in such a way as to put almost an insurance duty on the manufacturer in a case where a recall would take place. The other thing that members of the committee should remember is that, generally speaking, these products are not going into healthy people. They're going into very ill people who have a lot of problems and a lot of things that can go wrong with them regardless of the medical implant that they receive. When that happens, and understandably, or in some cases not so understandably, there is an attempt to look for somebody to blame or to hold responsible, and oftentimes when it's in the context of somebody having received a medical device, that manufacturer becomes the initial target. One of the problems with Representative Cornish's bill was that it really didn't distinguish or define well what it meant by recalls, because there's lots of things under the federal regulatory scheme that are categorized or classified as recalls, which don't necessarily involve a defective product. And I think the committee that heard this last time heard that some recalls may be nothing more than just provision of information or a communication of information as opposed to a request for removal and replacement. Under the statute that was introduced, it didn't make any difference whether it was defined as conveying of information or a formal recall. In either event, the manufacturer would be held liable for the process. And it ran. It ended up creating situations that were quite anomalous in the sense that you could have one of these communications of information which would be technically classified as a recall. Patient product works fine, because in most instances you should recognize that the failure rates on these products are very, very small. I think Dr. Alpert was talking in the area of 1 to 2%. Some of them are even less than that. But you may have a product like that, but because there was a communication, a recall by definition, the manufacturer would be liable even though 98, 99 or more percent of the people really had nothing wrong with the product. They may continue to use their product for 4 or 5 or 6 years before it has to be replaced in the normal course of its use. But at that point, because it was a recalled product, when it was removed and replaced, the manufacturer would have been, under the proposed legislation, responsible for the costs of that. You know, these things have to have batteries replaced. If a patient was having a battery replaced at a certain point in time, perhaps just short of the life of the battery, under the bill, as I understood it and as it read, the manufacturer would be responsible for that normal replacement if the product was listed as a recall. Even if you had a product that had a 0.1% defect rate or risk rate, if that product was deemed to have been subject to a recall, the other 99.9% would be recalled products, which would require the manufacturer to pay the total expense. As you've heard, the business in Minnesota is a very important business to the state, and to make these companies insurers of their products as opposed to using the conventional tort law, which is in place and which has been in place for many years to resolve these problems, is an ineffective and detrimental result, which is not only bad for the companies, but it's bad for patients in the long run. As you've heard today, the FDA does supervise the design, testing, manufacture, sale, and recall of all these products in great detail. And one of the things that you as state legislators have to think about is the fact that the FDA has this very elaborate, detailed regulatory scheme which governs virtually all aspects of medical device manufacture and sale. And the manufacturers are given very little, if any, leeway to depart from the federal scheme. In fact, departures from the federal scheme oftentimes will result in sanction, recall, branding of adulteration or mislabeling by the FDA, which has very severe consequences. When you, as state legislatures, undertake to start to regulate this same field, a couple of things you have to at least be aware of. One is that the regulations which you may impose may be in contradistinction from, if that's a word, but different from certainly the FDA regulations, and you may be placing on a manufacturer an obligation that will put it in conflict with the Food and Drug Administration. Additionally, although we like to think of ourselves as being the top state, there are 49 other states out there. And if each state comes up with its own legislation to regulate medical devices, the manufacturer is then faced with a situation where they are obligated to comply not only with this very complex federal system, but 50 state systems, many of which will, I would guarantee you, just because of the laws of chance, contradict one another in some form or fashion, placing the manufacturer in this very, very difficult position of who do I respond to? Whose law do I respond to? And do I have to sell my product and make my product and market my product different in 50 different states to accommodate the individual state laws while trying to keep Big Brother, the Food and Drug Administration, happy at the same time? And so it does create some real issues. Although the state does have certain capacity, mostly through the tort system, to regulate the actions of manufacturers, you have to think very carefully about the impact this will have on the federal scheme and on the effect it will have of other states regulating this. As the reimbursement statute that was proposed by Representative Cornish went, the recall statute, much of what he sought to do is already covered under state and federal law. Recalls are strictly controlled by the federal law. There's rules for notice laid out in the federal code. There's new rules on repair, replacement, refund, and reimbursement in 21 U.S.C. Section 360. There are a variety of federal rules that govern this. In addition, state law provides for subrogation for health care insurers, managed care programs pursuant to MnSTAT 62A.095. MnSTAT 548.36 provides for collateral source calculations in the event of litigation and trial verdicts that will make sure that healthcare providers who have a subrogation interest or a lien are reimbursed for the amounts they've spent. So there are provisions existing in state law that will protect third-party payers, and the tort system is designed to protect the individual patient who may feel that he or she has a cause of action against the manufacturer for an allegedly defective product. That's how their reimbursement comes, and they're prohibited from double reimbursement. They can't collect for the cost of their medical treatment both from a third-party payer, an insurer, and from a tortfeasor. They only get to collect that one time. So the rules are out there, and they have worked well, certainly for the 35 years that I've been doing this, and I expect they will continue to work well. The products liability law in Minnesota is well defined on these issues of manufacturer liability in a recall situation. When you take them in conjunction with the existing federal and state law, patients are protected, and the kind of legislation that has been previously proposed runs the risk of disrupting that delicate balance that exists. I think that kind of covers what my comments were, but I'd be happy to respond to any questions from the committee.
Mr. Price, I have a question. Are there special rules or how does the TORS system work for medical products, particularly implantables vis-a-vis you got an automobile that's defective. In other words, the situation with an automobile, you have there's something with the automobile that's defective. There's a fire, there's an injury. The individual can bring a products liability action against the manufacturer for certain and potentially others to seek to redress the injuries. Do the same rules, theories of liability apply for medical devices? In other words, I have something implanted into me and it fails. It is faulty. There's a defect and I'm injured. Do I have the same theories of liability that I would have if I were injured with another product?
The answer to that is an unqualified yes and no. The yes,
clear as mud.
Yeah, the yes is that, yes, the same theories will apply, whether it's a theory of negligence or strict liability. Sometimes breach of warranty comes in, but that's a less prevalent theory in personal injury. Where it's different for medical devices, and I alluded to that a little bit in my earlier comments, is that the law recognizes that certain products, pharmaceutical products, medical devices, for example, can be designed and manufactured with all of the due care and all of the effort and all of the scientific knowledge available and still contain risks associated with its use. And so the law formulating, for example, instructions to the jury and formulating the rules by which we operate makes exception for certain products which have unavoidable risks. It's referred to oftentimes as unavoidably unsafe products. The best example, it's a classic old example, was the old rabies vaccine. You know, if you were bitten by a rabid bat, you were going to die. No questions about it. Once they invented the rabies vaccine, they had something that would be effective for maybe 80 or 90% of the people, but there were terrible side effects to it, and you may end up having a reaction from the side effects. But the law recognized that you couldn't make that product any safer, and that there was great social utility to having a product out there to do that, and it sort of takes into account the risk. And it's only when you have a product that vastly exceeds the acceptable and designed concept of risk. If you've done all your testing and all your analysis and you conclude that your product, your medical product when implanted in the body will have about a 2% failure rate, and you go to market and you discover somewhere down the road that you've got a 20% failure rate, then you may have a situation where your risk has exceeded your benefit, and you may have then a defective product. It also gets into the warning issue, because a lot of times you can't get rid of the defect, you can't get rid of the risk, you can't get rid of the unsafety, and your duty then becomes to adequately warn the patient of the risk.
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Price, I had great concerns with the Tony Cornish bill that we heard earlier this session. I'm wondering, you talked a little bit about one of the consequences would be the potential conflicts with FDA requirements and whatnot. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the other maybe invisible costs or even the visible costs, such as what happens with, you know, if we have to worry about that what happens with R&D costs or what happens to patient costs. And then my second question would be, you might have answered this already, I'm not sure, but have other states looked at taking this type of action? Or are we the first state that has considered this increased liability for medical device companies? And then the third question would be, have you had a chance to talk to Representative Cornish and his constituent to see where he is going with this year, or if he's satisfied that this bill is probably not in the best interest of Minnesota?
Mr. Price.
Mr. Chairman. Representative, let me. I'll go in kind of reverse order, and then when I get to number one, you're going to have to remind me what your question was again. I have not had an opportunity to talk to Representative Cornish after the hearings last time. We indicated that the medical industry in Minnesota would be happy to meet with him and to work with him on coming up with proposed legislation that would work for everybody. And so we are available and amenable. We had kind of hoped he was going to be here today, but unfortunately, I gather he wasn't able.
I did speak with Representative Cornish, and he is interested in continuing to look at the issue. He was unavailable today. I have had an opportunity to talk to him on a couple of occasions, and I suspect that he very well may be in contact with you and others as we move forward.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative, we welcome that, and certainly Mr. Gearhart and others, members of the Medical Alley, would like to work with him. As far as other states go, I cannot tell you whether there have been other bills that have been introduced comparable to this. I just don't know. I haven't seen it. Now, your first question was, give me...
Albert's shaking her head no.
Okay, she would probably know even better than I. Your first question, just give me a clue.
Representative Kevin.
Yes, sorry about the triple whammy there. I was just wondering about some of the other costs. What would this, if this legislation passed, what would happen to R&D to future research and development, and what would happen to what would that do to the pricing, the current cost that's passed on the consumer?
Mr. Price.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, to be perfectly bluntly realistic, and this is coming from a lawyer and not from somebody who's in the companies, my perception of it is that these costs never are ultimately borne by the manufacturer. They get passed along as part of the cost of doing business. And whether it's a recall situation, whether it's reimbursement to insurance companies, et cetera, whether it's litigation, these costs ultimately will make these products more expensive for everybody. And everybody ends up then paying higher medical costs. And litigation and these sorts of things is a very expensive proposition, and it's not one that companies relish, number one, and number two, they really can't afford to absorb that cost in and of themselves. I'll give you an example. When I was doing silicone gel breast implant litigation for 3M, a company over here in St. Paul you may have heard of. I used to talk to the general counsel, and we talked about whether we would have a mass settlement of these cases. And he said, you know, every time we try and win one of these cases, we try it, we win it from the jury, it costs us about $1 million to do. We've got 20,000 of them. Do the math. We can't afford to win all our cases. So we have to figure out some way to handle the costs. We do a settlement. Some of it's covered by insurance. But, you know, when it's covered by insurance, the insurance premiums go up. If the company has to redesign a product or reevaluate its marketing, et cetera, those costs get factored into the cost of the product.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Price, first of all, I just want to go back. We're talking about Representative Cornish's bill, and I have to be frank and say I don't really remember real clearly what his bill was, but I've kind of gotten the gist of it from the discussion here. But I feel like we're sort of unfairly giving his bill a hearing without having both sides present. So let me just start by saying that. I wanted to to ask you, first of all, you gave us a bit of your background. Are you representing a client here today? Are you a lobbyist? I just want to be really clear what you're, or are you just here as sort of an independent expert?
Mr. Price.
Mr. Chairman. Good question, Representative Wiggling. I'm here because I was asked today by Mr. Gearhart from Life Science Alley to come over and testify. I had previously come to testify when Representative Cornish's bill was before the committee, and at that time I was originally asked by a group called AdvaMed, which is a group, a national trade group for companies that manufacture medical devices. Now, in all fairness, I represent many of the companies that we've been talking about here today, but have not been retained by them to do this. And in fact, one of my partners, Rich Forschler, who some of you may know, the last time I was in the office said, if you have to go back and do this again, we're going to have to register you as a lobbyist. And I said, me? Yeah. But that's how I happen to be here today.
Representative Liebling, I would note we intentionally don't have Representative Cornish's bill in front of us today because it is not my intention to have a hearing to mark it up, to amend it, to change it. I want to give Representative Cornish an opportunity, if he so desires, to continue to work on this issue. The Health Committee did have a hearing. They rejected his bill. The motion to pass his bill on failed, and it's not my intention to, I didn't want to have a discussion just about Representative Cornish's bill. That really was the genesis for the reason why the hearing's being held today. These issues are clearly critical to Minnesota businesses and to our Minnesota economy and to Minnesota patients as well. And so I wanted to make sure we were able to have a discussion. I have had many discussions with Representative Cornish about his bill. He wasn't able to be here today. But the fact that we don't have his bill in front of us is intentional on my part because I didn't want this to only be about his bill. I wanted an opportunity for us to discuss these issues in general and more broadly. We're clearly well past committee deadline, and I guess unless he pulls a floor amendment out of his pocket, which I don't anticipate him doing, but who knows? We've seen a few amendments this year on the floor. I don't think we're going to have his bill or another bill like it in front of this committee this year, but I suspect many of us are going to be back, and hopefully this committee will be back during the next legislative session, and I, from my discussions with him, I don't think the issue is going away.
Yeah.
Representative Lieberman.
Thank you. Well, Representative Colt, I that's fine. I'm not taking a position, and Mr. Price, I'm not, I hope you don't think that I'm asking it as a hostile question. It really isn't. It's just, it's a sincere question, and I'm not taking a position on his bill or his proposal. But I do just think that if we're talking here about the whole issue of tort liability, and I appreciate you've given us some very good information, and I'm not really familiar with this area, so I'm glad to get the information, but the whole issue of, you know, what tort liability does in terms of distributing the costs, I mean, if somebody is harmed by a product, clearly somebody is bearing a cost. And then the question arises of how that cost should be distributed, who should bear that. And I don't know if with you here, although I appreciate that you're not here with a lobbying for a client, but yet you do represent a very distinct point of view. And there may be a lot of legitimacy, I'm sure there is, a lot of legitimacy to that point of view. But there's also another point of view here that we're not hearing that isn't represented apparently since there's no plaintiff's attorney on this list. And we're not really talking fully about the economics of how this all plays out. So I just want to put that out really clearly, that what we're getting here is really one side. And that may be the side that, you know, prevails. I mean, I'm certainly not here with a proposal to change tort liability in Minnesota for medical products, but I just want to put that out there. And you did spend a certain amount of time talking about sort of talking against regulations that we might go toward that would put us in conflict with the FDA. And I just wanted to explore that a bit more with you, because Dr. Alpert, I thought, made it really clear that we couldn't even go there. And I don't know that any state is going there. And I thought when you were talking about that, you weren't talking about tort liability. You were talking about actually some kind of regulatory scheme covering the products themselves or the way they come to market or something. Could you just go into that a bit more?
Mr. Price.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leland, with regard to your first point, let me just make one other point, which is that, you know, the whole system of products liability is sort of designed with the idea of risk spreading, that a manufacturer take into account the potential cost of liability for its products when it prices the product so that it's spread across the society as a whole. What ultimately happens is if there are unexpected costs, then those costs, the manufacturer has to go back and he can't do it with the products that are already out there, but it impacts the next round of products. And that's where that all comes. As far as the federal regulation issue, I never tell judges what they can and can't do, and I am loath to tell legislators what they can and can't do. It ain't good business. But what I would say is that there is a very detailed regulatory scheme with the FDA, and even when it gets down to the tort system, which is something that, in general, the legislature has great control over. There is a doctrine, and it's probably beyond the scope of a detailed discussion today, but a doctrine called federal preemption. And under that doctrine, the law is such that states are not permitted, on a constitutional basis, to impose rules and regulations which are in contradiction or in addition to the rules and regulations of the federal government. Now, there are a lot of exceptions and a lot of loopholes and a lot of things you can look at, and many state courts have said that state legislatures have certain leeway and that the rules and regulations that they impose of tort law are not preempted by federal law. The area of medical devices, though, is one where there is specific congressional mandate to the FDA to have exclusive control over the rules and regulations going into the marketing, manufacturing, sale, distribution, recall of medical devices. And that's one where there is a lot of litigation over whether that regulatory scheme preempts the state from issuing statutory law that would be in addition to or different from the federal scheme. I don't know if that's helpful to you or not. It's kind of a nutshell on it.
Thank you, Mr. Price. Representative Liebling, are you?
Just the comment that that's what law school is made of, right? Spend 2-3 courses on federal preemption, so I appreciate your answer.
That's what practices of law are made of, and we spend a lot of time in court on that issue.
Mr. Price, I want to thank you very much for your time, and I want to thank the committee for its time. This is issue that, as I said earlier, I don't think is going to necessarily go away anytime too soon. I really appreciate the time that everybody took to come down and help inform the members of this committee. And before we adjourn, I'm guessing that this committee will probably not meet again before the end of the session, barring some other really interesting topic that we should delve into for some period of time. So I want to thank Mr. Pender and Mr. Beers and Ms. Vaught for their help, and thank the members for their attention. It's been an interesting topic, as members know, and as some of the lobbyists here may know. This committee has never existed before. This is the first time that these industries and issues have been given a forum here in the Minnesota legislature. And so I'd also like to thank the leadership of the House for creating the opportunity for this committee to look at some of these issues. And we've had an opportunity to see some of the Minnesota businesses and talk about the genomics partnership and other really interesting things happening in this area. And it's my hope that this committee, this forum, will continue to exist in future legislatures. But with that, members, thank you very much, and we are adjourned.